Sarah Mock.
And we're discussing the how, might, and the what if behind the end of foundational elements of agri-food systems. Today, we're going to be talking about the end of dairy. This is going to be a two-part episode, one part focusing loosely on the supply side and the second focusing on the demand side. First of all, let me clarify, when we say supply, so what we're talking about today, we're going to be talking about things that are controllable within the farm gate for the most part. That includes resources entering dairies, so inputs, and it also includes products leaving dairies. One point that we're going to focus a lot on, particularly in the spirit of this end of theme we've got going, is small dairies.
So before we get into how we get to that end, we have to talk about where we are right now and how we got here. Cattle, to just go all the way back, first arrived in the Americas in the 1600s with European invaders. There are actually no indigenous cattle breeds in the United States. The modern dairy industry, though, was born in the 1920s, primarily due to two factors. One, pasteurization became common in the U.S. and milk could safely travel from farms to urban areas without becoming contaminated. And milking machines became common. I think that interesting fact would surprise a lot of people that in the 1920s, there was 55,000 milking machines on 5 million farms. So we've known for a very long time that milk is not possible without technology. Milking cows is very time consuming, very physically demanding. So technology and mechanization was vital to the birth of the modern dairy industry. In the 1930s, 70% of all farms had dairy cows, but only 14% were considered commercial. Basically, dairy was all about just making enough milk for your small operation to basically consume on the farm. On-farm refrigeration, though, in the 1950s was another leap forward. And by the 1970s, only 13% of farms had dairy cattle and 50% were commercial. Today, that has consolidated even more. There's about 40,000 dairy farms in the U.S. today, down from about 110,000 in just 1995. So lost almost 70% in the last 25 years. Farms are bigger than ever and primarily sell commodity milk products, basically like 99% sell commodity milk products. So that's how we got here in terms of just the physicality of the industry. But how did we get to where we are right now, which we've all heard and read those stories of the absolute decline of the dairy industry. So to talk a little bit about that, according to the National Farmers Union, dairy farms have only made net positive income 1 year in the last 10. Why is that? Overproduction. Overproduction has been a huge problem in the sector. There's so many different reasons for that. Technology is one. Breeding has made cattle extraordinarily productive. But demand for milk and dairy products has risen only modestly in recent years. That's because people can only eat basically so much milk, ice cream, yogurt, cheese, and associated products. And there's a lot of byproducts with some of the higher value milk products. So basically, cheese is a great seller. It's still very popular. People love it. But when you make cheese and you take out some of the milk solid, what you have left is skim milk. And if you can't sell your skim milk, that's problematic. Any kind of decline in fluid milk is pretty tough on the dairy industry in general, which has made the last two or three decades for dairy farmers pretty challenging. Though it is also worth noting that the dairy safety net, so the federal policies in place to protect dairy farms, is very strong. Actually, the 2018 Farm Bill, which was seen as a correction to the 2014 Farm Bill, had a retroactive insurance program in it. So basically, throughout much of 2019, dairy farmers could buy insurance for the part of the year that had already passed, which means that you're sitting in July of 2019 insuring the cost of milk from the beginning of 2019. So you could literally know exactly how much money you were going to get out of the program because the time had already passed. So yeah, the USDA estimates that 2,500 dairy farms have gone out of business just since 2015. U.S. dairy cows are producing three times more milk today than they were in the 1960s, about 6 gallons a day. So if you personally are not consuming 6 gallons a day, really, are you doing your part? I think it's an open question. But despite the shrinkage in participants in the dairy sector, the number of cows total in the U.S. herd has not declined. So it's not that when these farms go out of business, they're selling off the cattle or sending them to market to be slaughtered. Big herds are actually absorbing the small ones, and the average numbers are remaining the same. So despite the fact that we've gone from there being the average number of cows on a farm in the last 100 years started out at between 1 and 5. And now today we're up to almost 250 cows is the average. So huge evolution, revolution in the dairy industry over the last 100 years. And it doesn't look like the change is really slowing.
Okay. I want to jump in here and go potentially in two different directions, but let me, one on the economic, one on the environmental side, but honestly, they're going to become increasingly interlinked. But we just talked a lot about the U.S. herd. One thing that's happening right now in the EU is a need to reduce emissions, which basically means culling cattle, and that means culling dairy herds. I wonder if there's any kind of effect that happens, any effect in the U.S. on that front. I would guess not, but maybe, I don't know. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. And then secondly, why, obviously subsidies, but what, and also massive land, but how has the U.S. gotten to have such a huge herd size when, and is the rest of the world going to do the same thing? Or what kind of makes that happen?
Yeah, to your second question first. So the massive herd size in the U.S., I don't know that I have the expertise to answer that question. Where what I believe would be true is dairy industry is on the technology treadmill like almost no other part of agriculture, which basically means they are very productive, they overproduce, then the price drops. Then the only way when you have low prices to get enough money to pay off, you know, your debts and make enough money during the year is to produce more. So despite the fact that a dairy farmer might see falling prices all year long, the solution at the end of that year is not to sell something. It's to buy more cows so that you can sell more to make up the difference. So I think the main driver of the growth of the U.S. dairy herd has been, counterintuitively, low prices. And, you know, other things too are related, massive innovation in creating dairy products. The fact that things go out of style in the 70s and 80s or 90s, maybe cottage cheese was very popular and that was a big market. And now cottage cheese is languishing. Butter has come back into vogue in the United States. So there's so many things in the dairy space go in and out of vogue very dramatically. We're pretty good, especially right now that America and much of the world is obsessed with protein. We don't consume enough protein. Dairy is a good source of protein, though it's not animal free, which is what a lot of people are looking for. So I think the size of the dairy herd is more just a reality of the economics than it is of specific policies or specific American love of dairy or anything. But I think to the second half of that question, will the rest of the world follow? Other countries have really bold, maybe not really bold. For example, in Canada, the supply management is basically where the government decides how much to produce and offers contracts to dairy farmers. And that's how they control the supply to prevent this overproduction problem that we have in the United States. Pros and cons to doing that, not at all saying that kind of system is better than what we have in the US, but it does solve the overproduction problem, which is the primary plague of the dairy industry. So Canada prevents it in that way. So in other countries, there's different ways of managing that. I would say there's also interesting examples out there like India. India has a fascinating system where they dairy because of it's particularly important culturally. They have a co-op system called Amul Dairy that basically helps 5 million essentially individual dairymen, people who have 1 to 5 dairy cattle. They can bring their milk, their small quantities of milk to an Amul little mini distribution center at the village level, get paid daily. And then the co-op turns that around and delivers milk and other dairy products all over India by basically the next day. A really incredible process, especially at the scale that it is, probably only achievable in a place like India where there's just some different cultural norms and an incredible different sense of priorities, and also basically some amount of poverty is a part of that because of how small the producers are. So there's certainly other ways to set up a dairy industry. The way the United States has set up our dairy industry is certainly not necessarily the most practical way. It's not the most obvious way. And certainly every country sets up their system differently. And they are at odds too. One of the reasons why one of the purported reasons why the Trump administration wanted to renegotiate the USMCA was because of, quote unquote, Canada's unfair practices when it comes to their supply management program and how it disadvantages US producers, because basically the US says, well, it's not fair that the US doesn't get to sell as much dairy into the Canadian market because of their supply management program. So yeah, there's lots of different ways to set up a dairy program, very different from the United States. I think there's a lot of other options out there, as there is in other parts of agriculture. I don't see as much of a trend of other countries, especially other major countries, following exactly in the US's footsteps. I think the US has made this bed and now we're lying in it.
Yeah, interesting. I think that there's almost a flip side to be made. Something I've been noticing a lot lately, in the tech space especially, and lately, I guess, being the past, really, I'll say 2 years, but especially taking off with COVID, is this real belief that we're going to go to hyper-regionalism and actually set up the co-op kind of mechanism that enables small dairy producers to sell regionally and not direct to consumer exactly, the like small co-op hybrid version of that. And it's interesting because people are like much more bullish on it than they were before. And I at least with a dairy in particular, I feel like that's pretty reactionary to a lot of pain and not necessarily in a like desperation kind of thing. But anyway, maybe I also am the kind of person who would buy from that. So I don't, who am I to say? Maybe it could work. Let's quickly talk about what might the end, we're really talking about small dairy ending here. What would the end of small dairy look like?
Yeah, I'll preface this conversation by saying this is a true existential possibility, not even that existential, kind of a realistic possibility that dairy farmers have been dealing with for a couple of years and are continuing to deal with kind of day in and day out. A brief anecdote, I even talking to some, as a reporter interviewing people at places like the American Farm Bureau 2 years ago, I talked to dairy farmers about, is the farm bill going to do enough for you? What is needed to like save your operation? And people said, federal programs are great. There's a lot of things that we need, but the fundamental problem isn't that we're not getting enough support. The fundamental problem is that prices are too low. There's too much supply and no individual dairy farmer can move on that realization on their own. Because in a market system like this, there's oversupply. If you make less, that doesn't affect everyone else's supply. That just affects you and your bottom line. So I think there's certainly a recognition, especially on the small side of dairy, that this is not the question of if, but when. And I think, to me, the obvious thing that was a bit of a death knell, maybe, for the small dairy space was Walmart building their own processing plant in Indiana in 2018. And this move towards, there's already a lot of vertical integration in agriculture, but dairy co-ops have been powerful organizations in the past, basically groups of farmers who come together to market their products. There's still very powerful dairy co-ops in the US, but in the last couple of years, there's been a couple of big mergers between dairy co-ops, and that have basically because of bankruptcies, because these co-ops just can't make it work anymore. And then especially one of the things that have led to that most directly is integration from these big retailers. If you're selling fluid milk, if you're not selling to Costco and Walmart and these super big retailers, if they're going around co-ops directly to sourcing milk themselves, the motivation there is for those companies, it's always cheaper to work with a few bigger producers than it is to work with hundreds, if not thousands, of small producers. So the more integrated the supply chain gets, because these big retailers are, I don't know, tired of working with the co-ops or don't like that they can't apply enough price pressure on the co-ops, are going to move more and more towards this vertical integration. And that's just puts more and more price pressure. Farmers throughout kind of Indiana and Ohio and other parts of the Midwest lost big contracts when that processing plant got built. But yeah, there's the vertical integration, the move towards just emphasis on bigger operations, because for so many different reasons. One, big operations have more money to invest in technology. They have more money to invest in responding to regulations. They can get those economies of scale. There's a lot of benefits that small dairy farmers, there's a lot of fixed costs with dairy farming that a small producer can't spread out over as many cows. And then if they're also trying to market their milk on top of that, especially trying to win contracts with companies like Walmart, there's just no way they can do it. I think the end cometh by big companies, especially big grocery retailers, moving towards vertical integration and just further cutting small dairies out of the market equation.
That's bleak. But yeah, I don't disagree. So let's dive a little bit into maybe some of the consequences of that, because one, I have worked a bunch in dairy and really dairy technology specifically, and looking at barrier. It's really interesting because the dairy industry is super tech hungry. It is a great place to be investing in ag tech to some degree, because these co-ops and these massively consolidated co-ops are really willing to invest in the space and even invest in technologies that could maybe last-ditch effort save small dairy, because there is this romanticization of it. And these are people's businesses. It sucks on a lot of levels. But then the flip side is, like you mentioned, there are inherent efficiencies in big operations, and you have more money to invest in technology. You also have more money to resist regulations. So you can respond to them if they're there, but they're not necessarily going to be there. And I mention that because one thing that never thought I would be, but I'm particularly passionate about, is manure technology innovation. Huge opportunity to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. Challenge is not the technology, the challenge is the adoption side. And so with these big operations, there's pros and cons. One pro, I suppose, I'll be positive first. Diversified income streams are a good thing most of the time when you're trying to run a business. When you're a giant dairy operation, you are operating much more like a business than you are operating like an individual. And we get into this a lot in these kind of agricultural customer conversations, where farms are businesses, but oftentimes they're run by kind of individuals who are thinking a little bit more like consumers. So you've got this funky direct-to-farmer sort of thing, is this weird hybrid of direct-to-consumer and but business-to-consumer or business-to-business, like it's weird in the middle thing. But as you go bigger, it truly becomes business to business, and you're able, hopefully, to make more rational business decisions, which is cool because it enables you to say, hey, where else can I make money in this operation, and how can I diversify my risk? And the answer to that is, let me sell something other than dairy, because the dairy market is flooded. And so how can I use all of this? And a dairy is a phosphorus mine. Poop is fertilizer, and also water, and depending on your market, there's so much opportunity there. And again, the challenge is figuring out how you can actually convert that into something that's marketable. And it's very difficult to do if you're very small, because then you have to deal with the aggregation kind of component. But if you're big enough and you can handle that upfront investment, you might have another revenue stream that is in a space that fertilizers really gets to be a very interesting topic, particularly things like phosphorus, because there's actually a finite supply and nitrogen is wicked expensive. And anyway, that starts to interplay with regulation, which would be like the other carrot of the stick way to increase the sustainability of dairy operations. And I think it's easier to think about the carrot opportunity when you're a large dairy operation.
I think there's just like more, in a lot of ways, there's just more headspace. Like, I think bigger operators tend to just have a little, like, they're able to, this is something that is true all over agriculture. When you're a small producer and you're at once the mechanic and the veterinarian and the marketing guy and the budgeting and HR, and you're in charge of all those things, you just don't have as much headspace to consider these other options and to be looking for other ways, to be thinking about ways to diversify your operation. And yeah, bigger operators tend to be more open and have more time to get on the phone and talk to a startup CEO. And yeah.
The other side of that, though, and then in theory, co-ops can do this too, but the other side of that, I hesitate and get nervous to talk about actually in the wonderful world of agriculture, is the regulatory side. And it's interesting because the regulatory environment in Europe specifically Ireland as relates to dairy, and the US. And so the issue with massive dairies is you've got these giant corporations making all the decisions, and that probably doesn't lead us down the pathway of necessarily the most sustainable practices. Maybe it can. I'm not saying it can't. I think that there's a way that it could, but that's significant as relates to what we'll talk about in episode number 2 of this dairy section, because there's the consumer perception of dairy that is important. Dairy marketing is like a miracle of a beast. It's amazing how well the dairy market, everyone knows Got Milk campaign. That is like one of the most, it's just great marketing. But there's a perception challenge, and it's somewhat reality-based around large dairies from a consumer standpoint. And there's, and part of that is an environmental, which is how you end up in getting into the like plant-based milks, I'll say, or I guess cultured milks, which we'll talk more about later. But there's an opportunity for large dairies to step up and say, hey, we're more environmentally friendly, and we're going to be really transparent, and we're going to show you how we're better than these other things from a, really from like an ESG, environmental social standpoint. But I don't know that they will take it. I don't know. What do you think? Think they'll take that opportunity? Think it's real, or am I deluding myself?
No, I think it is real. I think the evidence of this is like, right, Land O'Lakes, one of the biggest dairy co-ops in the United States, if not maybe the biggest, has launched their Sustain program. I think there's also another interesting, this is an interesting aside, the lobbying arm of dairy in Washington is led by Democrats. Dairy is the only group in, agricultural group in Washington that is true for, that doesn't like wildly go conservative on.
Probably hemp, I'm going to say.
Maybe. I don't know. Mitch McConnell is the like champion. So I don't know. But yeah, probably. But yeah, the leadership in dairy is, and all of this is probably driven by the fact, like, this isn't just Washington like inventing itself and deciding that dairy is Democrat. It's dairy states like Michigan and Wisconsin have traditionally been like working Democrat. Co-ops are like unions, basically. And I think people have associated that pretty strongly, associated those things pretty strongly together. And that's why the dairy industry actually in the US has called for supply management, as there is in the Canadian system, despite the fact that that's very kind of anti-free market. Supply management by definition is like peak socialism. It's literally the government deciding how much an industry produces to control the supply. I think that there's a real opportunity for dairy. I think dairy in a lot of ways is really trying to get in front of the environmental question and be a leader out there in front. I think the real, one of the real opportunities in agriculture right now is if you have the money to make the investment in environmental sustainability practices, doing it and then pushing for regulation, because it's to your advantage. If you're following a bunch of rules, make sure you are part of the conversation about what the rules are so that you'll already be following them, and then make everyone else follow them too. It's like an economic advantage to you. Not a very popular idea in ag, but we're talking about agriculture is a competitive space where businesses have to set themselves apart. Being environmentally sustainable and being able to tell that story and make those promises is a way to get out of the commodity space. And dairy could be a leader, especially because cattle, for whatever reason, for very specific reasons, mostly one 2007 report and the Green New Deal's less than ideal wording around cow farts, cattle have a pretty bad perception to consumers on the environmental front. Dairy cattle really could be, to your point, technology and innovation on the manure side to feed grain ration technology to reduce the amount of emissions they have, to lowering the herd size by creating more niche dairy products and finding ways to limit production and lower that size. There's lots of ways that dairy could not lose significant money, become a more premium product, and also become kind of leaders in the ag space on the environment. But I think taking that opportunity would require really setting themselves apart from potential allies in like the beef sector and other places in agriculture. And I think that would take this is a very hot take. I was going to say that takes more courage than maybe those folks have, but more maybe what I mean is like that takes, it takes a lot of investment, and the dairy industry has not had the last 10 years that they needed to make those investments.
And it takes a lot of reputational risk too, I think is what you're saying, and that it's true.
Exactly, and the reputational risk is, it's a gamble on both sides, because not only might they be turning their back on the rest of kind of the ag industry, but they're also, if they don't do it well enough, their lunch will get eaten on the plant-based dairy side. Who can say, oh, you think that those ethical dairy producers are good? Wait till you see our even more ethical plant-based meat. So they have to straddle a line between how do we set ourselves apart from the main industry, but not create a consumer base that's primed to choose plant-based over us.
Yeah, for sure. Following in the same vein as this conversation, if you just look big picture, it is like a solution to the dairy product flood, really, and to the environmental flood, and to the like cost reduction, like in terms of input costs for dairies. Problem would be, particularly in the US where we do have a lot of land, would just be really more pastured dairy. That feels like you're gonna get lower yield, but actually that's okay because we have a supply problem. And that just seems like that could just be the solution. And if you could just wave a magic wand, wouldn't that fix things? And actually, it would even enable small dairies to continue to play because you'd be fixing the supply challenge. What am I missing there? Could that be a magic wand solution?
Yeah, I think you need a lot of technology, a lot more technology than maybe you'd think. Yeah, cows need to eat a lot to maintain high levels of production. They also, like in the US, we milk at least 3 times a day, which on most, even on relatively smaller dairies, to get 200 to 500 cattle through the milking parlor 3 times a day, you're basically milking constantly. There's always cows in the parlor. To pasture them, you would need definitely more people to just be moving the cattle all the time, because even just like moving them in and out of a milking, basically how a lot of systems work right now is like they might have access to the outside, but one, they also have access to grain, and cows being economical creatures, like most creatures are, if their choice is grass or corn, they're going to eat the corn and not the grass. You would need some kind of way to be able to transport either, or maybe milk in the field. That could be another option.
That's what I was thinking,
They'd have to have some cool like cooling technology in them and aggregation technology. They'd have to be able to clean themselves, because obviously like cleanliness is really important to that food safety element. But yeah, I think that's the biggest thing. The biggest reason why we keep dairy cattle, I don't know if it's the biggest reason, a significant reason why we keep dairy cattle in barns is because they just need to be milked so often that they need to get back to the barn so regularly that they can't really get that far away, which means you can't really get that many cows on that much pasture, because cows need a lot of space to graze, which of course, and cows are lazy. They're, as I love to say, European swamp dwellers. They love to stand near water and they love to loaf in the same place, especially if they're not hungry enough to go find good grass. So if they need to come back to milk, which a lot of cattle want to be milked, it's very uncomfortable for them to go too long between milkings because their udder gets full and it gets painful. If cows know that they have to come back to be milked, they are eating corn anyways to supplement their diet. Even if they had an open door to a big field, they're not going to go very far, which just means you're going to concentrate manure and urine closest to the barn, which means you're going to kill all the grass there anyways. And eventually, like, you're going to create this weird thing where there might be a big pasture out there, but the grass is far enough away that none of the cows ever go out to it.
Yeah,
it's funny to like optimize for like cows' natural laziness, cows' natural desire to eat high nutrition food versus grass, which is relatively low nutrition compared to super concentrated feed. And then also, yeah, the actual milking question. But yeah, I think there's also like maybe a biological question about condition. Cows like to be warm. They're babies. Those happy cows come from California commercial is true. Range cattle out in a blizzard or out in on a mountain slope in Colorado or New Mexico are not going to produce as well and are not going to be as happy as cattle who get to sit in a barn all day and eat corn. So yeah, it would lower production. Whether people would be okay with that, I don't know. Probably. Seems like it. I don't know.
Well, those are all things. We're an exporter, so no, because we're the U.S. agricultural system doesn't think that way. We think in terms of how can we get more to send more out? And then we say, Canada, why won't you take it? It's interesting, though. I think that's an engineering problem that's actually fairly able to be solved for at some point. One would think that, oh, yeah, you could have a robot milking at different kind of points. And you could have a trailer kind of that is a refrigerated trailer. You move it around. There are solutions to that problem, but they're expensive and require this is where we won't get into agricultural robotics. We'll get way off, but it's difficult because you have to rethink the whole darn system.
Yes. Nobody wants to do that in agriculture.
Some people do.
That's true.
But not most, you're right. And then one last issue on the kind of ESG spectrum as relates to dairy is that we haven't talked about at all yet is the antibiotic and preventative veterinary treatment for dairy cattle. And this is, antibiotic resistance is real. There is a real consumer fear about this. There are countries that are taking dramatic regulatory steps to combat this. The U.S. is not being one of them. Not that they're not taking any steps, but relatively speaking, we're not taking very many steps. So it's interesting to think about that as it relates to the end of small dairy and therefore the existence only of large dairy. In theory, right now, it seems quote-unquote easier to operate a small dairy without using preventative treatment. And this is, I am not a vet. We're getting out of my expertise, so I'm doing some speculation here, warning. Anecdotally, though, it is easier, it's safer for the cows to be in a smaller farm, blah, 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 blah. And so you can operate with fewer antibiotics and you can have that quote-unquote natural or whatever kind of consumer story you want to tell that says this hasn't been treated with any kind of antibiotics or growth hormone or hormones being the other kind of, but that's really a confusing thing because that's really for beef. But my suspicion is that in reality, small farms can't afford to be giving so much preventative care or it's some marriage of those two things where a larger operation can afford to be bringing in vets on a regular basis, even on staff, so that you can more effectively, again, reduce risk in your investment in all of your cows in a way that small dairies can't afford to do. But yeah, I think that's worth mentioning. And I don't know, Sarah, does that check out? I'm speculating a little here.
That seems like it makes sense. For me, it falls into that category of, there's just fixed costs in dairy and you can always cut corners, but there's serious risk that comes with that, especially as things in the environment change rapidly. There was some interesting reporting recently about just the spread of diseases and how global climate change is going to impact it. And as animals become more concentrated and people interact with them, and as farms expand into wild areas, there's more chance for cattle to interact with other animals that they could get diseases from, basically. There's the risks of not being able to invest in things like high quality vet care are going up, kind of like meta risks. And small dairies are less and less capable all the time of investing to prevent those risks. And big dairies are able to adapt to them and deal with them as they come up. So I think that's just one more kind of disadvantage. That is maybe more in the existential threat side than in the physical immediate threat. But it's a threat nonetheless.
Yeah. So I think to consolidate a lot of what we've been saying here, what we're really saying, and it sucks to hear it, is it's safer from most standpoints to have large, fairly industrial dairies than small dairies, and it's much more efficient. And that's what it sounds like we're saying in summation. Sarah, what do you see actually the future being?
So the future, which is in a lot of ways already here, I think, is that we have an extraordinary small number of extremely large dairy farms. There's already a number of these very large dairies in California and the Southwest, including Nevada, Arizona, Utah, and Mexico. They're going to work really closely with big brands and corporations to supply the vast amount of fluid milk and dairy products to the market. And I think as small consumer packaged good brands consolidate and are bought by these bigger brands, that's only going to get worse. And then if you're not a mega dairy with tens of thousands of cows and dozens of people on your staff and on staff vets and millions of dollars worth of top of the line technology, and you still have dairy cattle, I think it'll be because you've branded your product effectively enough to leave the commodity milk market space and make the investment in processing and marketing and are surviving in that way. So I think those kind of producers will likely sell direct to consumer or at least direct to retail and direct to restaurants. They'll have strong branding, strong regional following. I'm thinking of here in my area, we had a local Pennsylvania company called Trickling Springs that was a co-op and sold milk under their own brand and had an ice cream store in Washington, D.C. They recently went out of business for things unrelated to the actual production of milk. But I think those kind of brands or those farms that are able to build that, and especially farms that are able to skip the co-op and go straight from here's my farm products, vertically integrate from the farm. I think those people will be able to survive and be able to make the play. But I think otherwise, despite the fact that even though fluid milk sales are stagnating, butter and cheese are still super popular, I don't think dairy itself is necessarily going away. I think there's still a market there. But to compete with the vertical integration from retailers, farms have to pursue their own vertical integration. So all of that to say, I think co-ops are becoming less relevant. But I think like in the same breath on the reality check side, Horizon Organic and organizations like Chobani are also have sown supporting small family dairies into the brand of their products. And so those kind of brands are certainly going to help keep smaller dairy farmers around for a bit longer. But Tillamook, an interesting case, is recently got a lawsuit brought against it because people thought that watching their commercials or seeing some of their marketing stuff, people thought that they were getting their dairy primarily from very small kind of family dairies. And in reality, they were getting a good chunk of their dairy from really a couple of really large producers in the Pacific Northwest. And people thought that was misleading marketing and brought a suit against them. And I think there's going to be more and more of that because in terms of creating products, working with fewer producers just is lower cost. And unless the economics of selling food changes, which I think to other conversations we have had and will have again, direct to consumer, there's lots of things disrupting that relationship. But as long as the primary market for milk is still the grocery store, the only people who are going to be able to beat grocery stores at their own vertical integration game on dairy is farms or small brands that can vertically integrate themselves and create their own following. So I think that's what the future looks like. A couple of really big dairies a group of very big dairies that supply most of the milk in America, a group of small dairies that have regional followings and strong brands, and then basically very few other people with dairy cattle.
I don't disagree with most of that. I am going to add, one, we're going to talk more about the marketing side of it, Tillamook, and also like the fair lives of the world. And we're going to save that for episode two. What I want to throw in too for kind of my vision of the future, and I'm not sure how realistic this is, but man, do I want it to happen. And that is, dairies are going to produce more than just milk. They're going to have additional revenue streams. And this is generally what I am pushing for broadly across agricultural production, right? You can't have monocrops. Forget about environmental factors. Just think about economics. It's good to have diversified revenue streams. And so I think, yeah, big dairies, what does that enable? Nutrient recycling, circular on-farm economy kind of things. It actually enables some of these cool technologies that we've got, the cow pots, the Mitero, which is like milk t-shirts. I don't know if you've seen that, but do I want a Mitero t-shirt? Yes. And there's all sorts, and then there's the less sexy consumer end of things, but actually more interesting from an economic standpoint. phosphorus recycling, and this all this sort of stuff also contributes to feeding into regulatory environmental concerns. But yeah, I think, yes, you have a bunch of these big farms, and I think that they are in, I think that somehow we have to find a way to incentivize them to invest in these diversified revenue streams that enable some response to the emissions side of, you know, the climate change side of the equation, because we really, that's something we got to figure out here pretty soon. Yeah, I agree. Dairy's not going away. A medium dairy actually is really what it sounds like is going away. Small kind of continues to exist in niche markets, but not necessarily at the scale it once was. That's the future. And we'll talk about the whole plant-based side of things next, but that certainly doesn't change my outlook for this part.
Yeah. Absolutely. The only thing I will challenge you on is the idea of we need to incentivize dairies. I think that smart, forward-looking CEOs, founders, whatever, people who lead dairy organizations, whether those are farms or other, or creating a dairy product, if they're not like reading the signs of they have to figure out how to do this, like that,
that is incentive.
True. I'm just here to push back against the idea that something needs to be done for them. They need to do this for themselves.
Sure. I don't disagree. Well, and that's where this conversation about kind of dairy alternatives gets interesting, because it can be the push, part of the push that really breaks down what consumers want and maybe creates a little bit of fear that stokes action, which would be good.
Absolutely. It's just one of those places, dairy farming in particular, to this whole conversation where obviously we don't hate dairy farmers. We don't like hope for their demise. We don't think
dairy farmers even.
We love dairy farmers.
So far as to say.
There's a good question about how much of dairy farming is actually good business and how much of dairy farming is just our love of the idea of dairy farming. And people who treat their businesses like businesses and stay ahead and are competitive and set themselves apart and fight for markets and make individual decisions that do make sense, even when they can't make, if they can't make the optimal decision, they're making the second best decision, not just choosing whichever one like feels the best. I think those are the people who are going to make it one way or another, because they're going to be creative and innovative and find a way. And this is very much where the rubber meets the road in terms of, do we like the idea of the thing or do we actually like the thing? And are we going to optimize for the idea that we have of dairy farming or for actual successful dairy farms? And in a lot of ways, our desire to save dairy farms comes from our desire to save the idea of dairy farms more than it does from actually saving the real thing.
Totally agree. We're going to pause here and we're going to pick this conversation up again in episode 2. So stick with us, come back to talk a little bit more on the marketing end of all of this and the demand end. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of The End of Agriculture. And we'll catch you on The End of Dairy Part 2 next time.
Bye.